I didn't have any fixture music in my record collection, so this is as close as I can come. And you're supposed to be able to identify all the things.
Awarded later. We'll have to check into that. bachelor party this last night. Other joys, sorrows, Alita?
I got a wonderful letter from Joan Hartshorn, Callie and Hazel, kind of Pharaoh's daughter. First of all, thanking us again for all our support and delighted that we are getting copies of Rise Up Singing in honor of Tally. And she said she wished she could be here for our first song fest, so I thought I'd pass that on.
Sounds like a good idea to have one.
Yeah.
Orange.
This is more of a lesson that you need to share. Sorrow in our lives. A year ago, this time we were in this remodeling the store. Our new counter was designed by a talented woman designer named Rachel Jeffrey, and she died a week and a half ago of a stroke at age 47. It was a real blow, not a surprise. She was one of those people who was always rushing around, bursting with life. And we did have a joy this week that Eric has been cast as Ulysses S. Grant from the opera. Mother of Us All, which is about
as well as to entertain, and has been kept alive by the powerful oral traditions of the African peoples. There are many links between these African tales and the cultural descendants in the New World. Zomo, though separated from his origins in Hausa land, Nigeria, by an ocean and several centuries, lives on as Cunny Rabbit or Compère Lapin in the Caribbean, and as Rare Rabbit in the United States. Like tricksters and storytelling traditions around the world, the fleet-footed Zomo outwits his larger foes with guile and trickery. And like his African cousin, Spider and Tortoise, he uses his wit to gain wisdom. Zomo. Zomo the rabbit. He is not big. He is not strong. But he is very clever. This is Zomo. Time was, Zomo wanted more than cleverness. He wanted wisdom. He went to Sky God and asked for it. Zomo, it is not so simple, said Sky God. To get wisdom, you must earn it. How, asked Zomo? You must do three impossible things, answered Sky God. First, bring me the scales of big fish in the sea. Second, bring me the milk of wild cow. Third, bring me the tooth of leopard. I will try, said Zomo. Zomo went to the edge of the sea. He began to play his drum. He played so loud, his drum beats went down to the bottom of the sea. Deep below, Big Fish heard the music of the drum. Big Fish came up out of the water. He danced on the sand. Faster and faster, Zomo beat his drum. Faster and faster, Big Fish danced. Big Fish danced so fast, his scales fell off. Big Fish was naked. Splash, he jumped back into the sea. Quickly, Zomo scooped up the fish scales in his hat and hopped into the forest to get the fish scales. In the forest, Zomo climbed a palm tree. He looked all around. Then he saw a wild cow. Ha! Laughed Zomo. You are not so big. You are not so strong.
Who is that laughing at me? Asked Wild Cow.
It is me, called Zomo. I say you are not even strong enough to knock down this little tree. Wild Cow got angry. She ran at the tree to knock it down. Thump! She hit that tree. But the palm tree was soft. Her horns got stuck. Quickly, Zomo slid down the tree. He turned his drum upside down and floated his milk. By the time Wild Cow got unstuck, Zomo was far away. He's a rabbit. Zomo took the path to the top of a high hill. It was the hill where a leopard walked every day. Zomo tipped his hat and sprinkled a few fish scales on the path. Zomo tipped his drum and spilled a few drops of milk on the path. Then Zomo went to the bottom of the hill. He hid behind a rock. Soon, Leopard came walking over the hill. He slipped on the slippery scales and the milk. He rolled down the hill. Well, he looks pretty unhappy rolling down. Okay. Oh! Leopard hit the rock. His tooth popped out. Up jumped Zomo. He caught that tooth. Quickly, he hopped away. Zomo took the scales of Big Fish, the milk of Wild Cow, and the tooth of Leopard to Sky God. Sky God smiled upon Zomo. You are clever enough to do the impossible, he said. Now I will give you wisdom. Sky God spoke. Zomo listened. Three things in this world are worth having. Courage, good sense, and caution, said Sky God. Little rabbit, you have lots of courage, a bit of sense, but no caution. So the next time you see Big Fish or Wild Cow or Leopard, better run fast. Zomo is not big. Zomo is not strong. But now Zomo has wisdom, and he is very, very fast.
Thank you, Ann. All the children can go downstairs for
unless
you
want to sing the song.
Child care.
Our first song is about, the trickster's part of an old-time religion. And the words are by Pete Seeger, who is, in a way, a contemporary trickster.
It goes fast, I guess, so.
But let's not do the chorus after each verse. We'll get once after the first, okay. Just at the beginning and at the end.
Okay. Very
Oh,
I have two major sources for this program. One is a recent book by Lewis Hyde, Trickster Makes the World, which is really very good, and I can't do justice to it in 40 minutes. And the other is a book by Paul Raden, a Wisconsin anthropologist who published this in 1956, and it's a collection of Winnebago trickster stories, some of which I'll refer to. Let's start the program with a story that Lewis Hyde uses to open his book, and I'll skip the interpretation following the story and come back and discuss the story later on in the program. So no questions after this story. Dean will read the story. Actually, I had a question. How do you pronounce coyote or coyote? Could I have a show of hands for coyote? Should I have a show of hands for coyote? Coyotes have it, and I think it's because we're east of the Mississippi.
The first story I have to tell is not exactly true, but it isn't exactly false either. Once during the winter, after I got out of college, I was hitchhiking north of Winslow, Arizona. Just after sundown, three Navajo men in an old green Chevy picked me up. The driver I remember distinctly, as his hair was as long as mine, and he had lost the top of his right ear. He and his friends had been working a construction site near the New Mexico border and were headed home to Tuba City for the weekend. Two or three times in the fading light, we came upon coyotes crossing the road or slinking along in the nearby brush. And there began a somewhat reverent and somewhat joking discussion of coyotes and their ability to see in the dark, which led, in turn, to my hearing what I only later understood to be a very old story. Long ago, the driver said, coyote was going along, and as he came over the brow of a hill, he saw a man taking his eyes out of his head and throwing them up into a cottonwood tree. There they would hang until he cried out, "Eyes, come back!" Then his eyes would return to his head. Coyote wanted very much to learn this trick, and begged until the man taught it to him. "But be careful, Coyote," the man said. "Don't do this more than four times in one day." "Of course not. Why would I do that?" Coyote said. The others in the car laughed at this, but not the driver. When the man left, Coyote took his eyes out and threw them into the cottonwood tree. He could see for miles then, see over the low hills, see where the stream went, see the shapes of things. When he had done this four times, he thought, "That man's rule is made for his country. I don't think it applies here. This is my country." For a fifth time, he threw his eyes into the tree, and for a fifth time, he cried, "Eyes, come back!" But they didn't come back. Poor Coyote stumbled about the grove, bumping into trees and crying. He couldn't think what to do and lay down to sleep. Before too long, some mice came by, and, thinking Coyote was dead, began to clip his hair to make a nest. Feeling the mice at work, Coyote let his mouth hang open until he caught one by the tail. "Look up in that tree, Brother Mouse," said Coyote, talking from the side of his mouth. "Do you see my eyes up there?" "Yes," said the mouse. "They're all swollen from the sun. They're oozing a little. Flies have gathered on them." The mouse offered to retrieve the eyes, but Coyote didn't trust him. "Give me one of your eyes," he said. The mouse did so, and Coyote put the little black ball into the back of his eye socket. He could see a little now, but he had to hold his head at an odd angle with the eye in place. He stumbled from the cottonwood grove and came upon Buffalo Bull. "What's the matter, Coyote?" asked the bull. The buffalo took pity on him when he heard the story and offered one of his own eyes. Coyote took it and squeezed it into his left eye socket. Part of it hung up. It bent him down to one side. Thus he went on his way.
You have to think about it for a second. The trickster is a figure found in many primitive religions, that is, religions without a high god or organized pantheon. Frequently, the trickster is identified as an animal, a coyote or a raven or a rabbit. Sometimes the trickster has a more human form, such as Hermes in ancient Greek mythology, or Loki in Icelandic Scandinavian mythology. Actually, Krishna at times in Hinduism has the characteristics of a trickster. Tricksters are lords of the in-between. They're boundary crossers, like Hermes, messenger of the gods to the profane world. But as we will see, tricksters also create boundaries, the boundaries between the sacred and the profane. Just as an aside, the trickster is usually male, even if the trickster sometimes takes female form. It's not entirely clear why the trickster is usually male, since the trickster is found in societies that aren't all that patriarchal, and the trickster stories are often told by women. Paul Raven goes into some detail about how he got these stories. The Winnebagoes who believed the story wouldn't tell him. And he knew of one of his good informants, who had fallen away from the old religions, had a father who knew the stories, but the father couldn't tell the stories because he didn't have the proper role in society. But he, the informant knew of a woman who knew the story cycle and would tell him. The woman wouldn't tell Raven, because this sort of thing shouldn't be told to strangers, and especially to white strangers. She was his sort of indirect informant. Hyde has some speculations about why tricksters are usually men, and I don't find them especially persuasive, so maybe you can come up with an explanation later on. Anyway, here's a story, Al will read a story, about how trickster creates boundaries.
Once upon a time, the gods were closer to this earth. Once they walked amongst us and sat at our tables. But that was a long time ago, before the enduring divisions that shaped the world were drawn. The Fon in West Africa called the female portion of their androgynous creator Mau. She is the mother of the trickster, Legba. In ancient days, when Mau lived here on earth, Legba was her obedient servant. When he did a good deed, the people ignored him and thanked Mau. But when he did an evil deed, the people blamed him directly, as if Mau had nothing to do with it. Legba complained of this arrangement. Mau replied that in governing the world, it is best if the master is known as the good, and the servant to be known as the evil. Very well, said Legba. Now Mau had a yam garden, and Legba told her that thieves were planning to steal her crop. So Mau assembled all the people and announced that anyone who stole from her garden would be put to death. That night Legba stole Mau's sandals, and wearing them on his feet, stole all her yams. When the theft was discovered, Mau assembled the people and searched to find the foot that matched the footprints in her garden. But none could be found. Legba asked if Mau herself might have come in the night and forgotten about it. Who, me? That is why I do not like you, Legba. I will measure my foot with that footprint. But Mau put her foot down. It fit the print exactly. The people begin to laugh and shout. The owner herself is a thief. Mau was humiliated. She left the earth. She didn't go very far, though. Only about 10 feet up. And Legba was still her servant. Every evening he would come to her and give her an account of the day's activity and receive his instructions for the day that followed. And again, whenever Legba did something wrong, the people would blame him, and Mau herself would join in the reproach. Irritated, Legba conspired with an old woman. Every evening after she had washed her dishes, this old woman would throw the dirty dishwater up in the air and soak Mau with it. Angered, Mau soon departed. And now she lives on high, and Legba, her son, lives here on earth.
In a way, that's a dirty story, isn't it? Here's one. Here's another kind of version, if I can find it. You can be thinking about that story. In one of the raven stories told around Sitka, Alaska, raven steals water from the stingy petrel, who has an endless supply, but will not share it with the thirsty world. Petrel vigilantly guards the spring where his water bubbles up. He keeps it covered and he sleeps beside it. Raven tries to get Petrel to leave his hut by telling him tales of all the wonderful things happening in the world. But Petrel is suspicious and won't move. That night, Raven sleeps in Petrel's lodge. He goes outside, takes some dog shit, and smears it on Petrel's buttocks. As the sun rises, Raven cries out, wake up, my brother, you shat over all your clothes. Petrel runs from the lodge to clean himself, whereupon Raven takes the cover from Petrel's spring and begins to drink. As he flies away, water falls from his beak and turns into the great rivers of Alaska and all the little salmon creeks. Well, what does that story about Mau and Legba, what does it mean to you? Creating a permanent distinction. Mama goes up there. And of course, you can't do without human beings. That's, you really have to sacrifice to the gods to keep them happy.
But she called like the evil, he was a servant.
Well, let me get this.
Could it be a Pandora's box story, like where that explains why evil is with us on Earth, that stays with us on Earth?
I said that Michael wasn't really the one that was bad.
Yeah, it was Mama who ordered him to do bad things. The Petrel story is more like Prometheus. Kind of variation on that story.
But I think for one thing, it's a way of handling the problem of good and evil. How can a good God allow evil? And the point that this seems to tell us is that the God, while not creating the evil, is powerless against the evil. There's God and there's evil, and they can both, they each have their own realms of power. It's not as if God is creating the evil, but God is powerless against the evil.
Yeah, and that's a direction I might have time to go off in. Yeah.
I follow up with Bob. It said a free will thing. I mean, comparable to the notion that we're given the choice, God could stop it. He doesn't, because we have been given that choice. Our actions then adhere to us, not to
multiple dimensions. I'm going to stop. And that's I think true of myths in general. They're good stories.
I was just going to say that this is reminding me of all the research that I did for my mythology series several years ago. One of the books that affected me most, and which I didn't really use much from, was called Other People's Myths. And the author's thesis was that you are, no matter how hard you try to understand a myth from a different culture, you will always interpret it through the culture that you grew up in. Everybody here is using God in the way that we grew up in Judeo-Christian kind of background, you know. And people in other cultures may not have that same interpretation of God. Hindus certainly don't have the same interpretation. And so it's just very interesting to me that everybody is, you know, we're always kind of, no matter how hard you try, you're always kind of stuck in where you started from. You know, you can't really get beyond that, turn that corner unless you, you know, become part of that culture. So it's just an interesting thing.
My tribe is sociology, so let me go on with a sociological theme that I want to come back to later in the program. Religions very generally involve a division of the cosmos into a sacred realm and a profane realm. Sacred things are things set aside, approached with awe and trembling, while profane is the realm of everyday life, business, trading, work, sex, dirt, you know. And typically rituals are necessary before you can approach the sacred. Perhaps fasting, very often ritual ablutions and the like. Rituals are necessary when you leave the sacred to get into the profane. So when you stop your prayer, you say amen. It's a way of signaling that you're leaving the one realm for another. The kind of operational definition of the sacred is that if something is sacred, it can be profane, so that every mass creates the possibility of a black mass, and sacred speech implies the possibility of blasphemy, but you can come up with your own examples. I've had Muslim students in sociology deny this about religion involving a distinction between the sacred and the profane. They say, in Islam, everything is sacred. And my response was to ask what happens when people wear dirty shoes inside the mosque. And now I would ask, what happens if people write a parody about the Quran going Salman Rushdie's satanic verses. Anyway, in the story Al read, there's Al. You moved it. Lechbov separates the world of the sacred and the profane. And here in this process, Lechbov is a kind of creative figure. He's creating a kind of order. The universe is ordered into its sacred parts and its profane parts. And the dirt is always a part of a byproduct of creating order, because dirt is essentially matter out of place. It's not where it should be. You know, out there, dirt is okay, but in here. The Winnebago trickster stories include some really funny, dirty stories, more or less obscene and scatological. I would be too much embarrassed to try to read that. Trickster starts off with a very long penis, and it's a story about how it gets to normal life. Trickster becomes a woman for a while, to the point of having children. There's one story. The one I might read to you if I had time was about he comes upon a nut or something, and he's told not to eat it, because if he eats it, he will defecate too much. But he goes ahead and eats it anyway. And then there's a long description about, Anyway, having created the boundaries between the sacred and the profane, Trickster plays a distinctive role as the mediator, the go-between between the sacred and the profane. He is the messenger of the god. And very often he is involved in myths about divination, predicting the future, and rituals of divination, which are really quite important in many religions, not all of them primitive. In a curious way, divination, if you think of Roman, Greek, which you're likely to know about, or African divination, very often it involves a chance process, something like rolling dice. But the people who use the ritual believe in fate, and so you're using this process to predict what will happen in the future. If we have time, and I don't think we will, we'll come back to this. But there's a kind of paradox, you know, a world that involves both fate, which you can't do. Your fate is determined beforehand, and then there's chance, contingency, where things don't have to be as they are. And there's this kind of paradox, which is really quite common in religion. Anyway, as we noted already, the trickster often plays tricks on others. Not only human beings, but gods, as in the Legba story. But very often, the trickster is a victim of others or of his own foolhardiness, like Coyote in the story that Dean read. Barbara will read one story along that line. It's a story told in many cultures. This one, I don't know who the Okanagan are.
Okanagan.
What?
Okanagan.
Where are they?
Northwest
coast.
From central Washington up into Canada.
Yeah, Raiden has three different, sort of a cycle of three different bungling host stories for the Winnebago. And they're funny. So.
One of the most famous Native American stories, The Bungling Host, in which Trickster, hungry as ever, drops in on some animal friend, bear or kingfisher or muskrat or snipe, who catches and prepares food in his own special way. Here's an episode from the Okanagan version. And by the way, Mole is Coyote's wife. Mole is Coyote's wife. One time there was no food in Coyote's lodge. He went to visit his brother, Kingfisher. Kingfisher, what have you got to eat? Asked Coyote. I am very hungry. Kingfisher did not like this rude way of talking, but he sent for his son and told him to go get three willow sticks. The boy, Kingfisher, went out and got the sticks and came back. Kingfisher heated them over the fire until they were strong. Then he took them out, twisted them up, and tied them to his belt. He flew up onto the top of his lodge, and from there, he flew to the river and down through a hole in the ice. When he came up, there was fish hanging on each willow stick. Coyote ate until his belly was round, but he saved some fish for his wife and his children at home. You must come over and see me tomorrow, said Coyote. I don't think I will come over, said Kingfisher. Oh, you must come over. We will have a nice meal and you will like it. Come tomorrow. Kingfisher didn't want to go, but he said he would. The next day when Kingfisher came over, Coyote told his son to go out and get three willow sticks. When boy Coyote came back, Coyote stuck the sticks in the fire until they were hard. Then he bent them up and stuck them in his belt. Then Coyote crawled up to the top of his lodge. What are you doing up there? Asked his wife. Why, you know, I've done this before. I'm getting food for our brother Kingfisher. Coyote jumped off the top of the ledge, down off the top of the lodge, down to the river, but he missed the hole and broke his neck and was killed. Kingfisher had been watching all the time. He walked over to where Coyote lay and took the three sticks from his belt and jumped into the hole on the ice. Soon he came up with many fish. Then he stepped over Coyote four times, and Coyote came back to life. This is my way, not your way, said Kingfisher. I do not imitate others like you do. Coyote took the fish up to his lodge and showed them to Mole and the children. Look at these big fish. I caught them in the way Kingfisher did. Kingfisher is afraid of my power. He told me not to do this again. He knows my medicine is strong. Mole cooked the fish.
Think about the story.
Warren, I should tell you something about something that happened to us last summer when we were out visiting in the Northwest. Eileen's brother has a good friend who's a sculptor in the Northwest. Rich Fire is his name. And Rich is one of the premier sculptors that's commissioned to do community art. One of his most famous is called Waiting for the Interurban. It's in Ballard. And it's this set of figures that are standing along the street in a transit waiting area, and they get all dressed up and so on. So he's a very popular and famous artist in the Northwest. But Larry, I mean, his brother took us down a little dirt road to the Columbia River, across railroad tracks and bumping down to a place that nobody could see, and showed us out in the middle of the Columbia River on a rock is a sculpture that Rich Fire did of Coyote based on this story that he just donated to the world and put out there. Very few people know about it.
So, what is the significance of the bungling host?
One of these stories reinforce your role in society. I think when they're told to children, the moral is be yourself and don't make yourself too big or too important. They really do reinforce roles, and gender roles as well.
At least if you have a nature like Kingfisher. But it's not so clear if you have a nature like Coyote.
Yeah. It seems to me that the purpose of any trickster, that there's an interesting purpose, which is that in society, the main body of society has to accede to a certain level of rules for society to function. Yet there always is in society a number of people who don't pay attention to those rules. And those people can take us forward by ignoring rules, or they can fall on their rear ends, they can break their necks. But if you don't have those people are at one point, those people are people that are horrible, that the rest of society finds horrifying, like Kingfisher. And on the other hand, they are people who may lead you forward, like the story where Raiden gets the water. So I think that the trickster talks about a class of people that we need in society, but we don't want too many of them. On the one hand, they horrify us. On the other hand, they lead us forward, and we're amazed at what they do. And yet, so there's, because there's always a humor and an acceptance, but a little bit in there that you really don't want to act this way. So either the trickster is sort of, you know, hoist on his own petard and put down, or they end up doing something that benefits humanity. So I think it's a way of accepting a certain kind of people into society that we need, but we don't want, but we do.
Don't elect him president, yeah. that really is, I think, one of the major messages of Lewis Hyde in this book. So the book is titled Trickster Makes This World, but, you know, trickster is sort of a major source of change in the world. Without tricksters, you don't get change. Mary?
A few years ago, I spent a week or two summers up at the Lakota Indian Reservation, and there was an Indian man who was part of the Medicine Society, and he spoke to us and told us a lot of stories, like something like these. And the thing that I got out of it was I had never understood, you know, how you could be attracted to a story like this, you know, about a trickster figure. But what I got out of it is that people in this culture, and you know, me also by taking it in, instead of thinking you have to be perfect to contribute to your society, you can be a normal human being and do stupid things and do really horrible things still, but still contribute to your culture. And you know, especially I've been thinking about politicians, and I used to think, you know, politicians were, you know, the first time I voted for president, you know, that was, I was voting for someone who I could really.
Let me give you a little tight interpretation of the bungling host. Now, this is the tale of an animal that does not have, as Kingfisher says, a way. Kingfisher, or the host is other versions, snipe, polecat, bear, muskrat, each of these animals has a way of being in the world. Each has his nature. And specifically, each of them has his own way of hunting. And in these stories, at least, it works, and they're never hungry, because he has his way, while Coyote is always hungry. Coyote, on the other hand, seems to have no essential nature, no way, and no more knowledge or things like that. Coyote has the ability to copy others, but no distinctive ability of his own. So there is a way in which Trickster is more stupid than the other animals, and that comes out very clearly in the bungling host. Right? Animals have some inborn knowledge, some way of knowing how to do things, and Trickster doesn't. But, you know, if you think about it, not having a single way of being can be an advantage, so that although Trickster bungles quite frequently, he can also learn. The other animals must follow their ways, but Trickster can change his ways of behaving as the situation changes. And it's not surprising that tricksters are often personified by animals like the coyote or the raven. As you all know, the coyote is a very adaptable animal. In the past, you know, maybe 100-150 years ago, coyotes hunted in packs like wolves, and I think they hunted bigger game like deer, brought them down. In modern America, that hunting in packs no longer works, and the coyote now hunts solo. How many of us have seen a coyote in Dane County? But not too many. I saw one. I saw one in the Arboretum.
Yeah, you can hear
them
every once in a while there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Out of the Audubon Center, lying in the sun.
And don't watch out, a coyote might eat your pet poodle. Or coyotes are very, very successful, very adaptable. Wolves, on the other hand, are pack animals. They hunt in packs, and they're not nearly as adaptable. And until recently, they were an endangered species in this part of the country. Ravens, I think, are a very adaptable bird. You know, well, crows in our part of the country, so. If you don't have cornfields around that the crows can eat from, they'll try your garbage bag out on the street, and they're pretty good. I don't really know why rabbits are often personifications of the trickster, but then I've never really tried to chase a rabbit down. Anyway.
What about the snake in the story of the Garden of Eden?
I'll come back to that. Very short. Anyway, if you follow me, we human beings are rather like the trickster in the bungling host. We human beings are so plastic, so adaptable, so able to learn from others, and so stupid. us modern humans are especially like that. Some of the American Indians identified the whites as the trickster. The whites were so devious, they did not have a way, the way that maybe the Winnebagoes had a way. And in fact, that's the kind of interpretation that Lewis Hyde gave the coyote story that Al started the program with. later on, Lewis Hyde found an 1899 version of the story that began, White Man Comes Along. So, and the driver of the car might have thought about that kind of story. So here's this white kid hitchhiking along, far, far from his home in, I suppose, New England, burning up other people's gasoline, trying to see further. You know, sort of it's a story about hubris, you know, pride, you know, and so this white hitchhiker is a kind of person without roots, without a fixed way of being, whereas the Navajo, they knew where they were, who they were, and where they belonged. Okay, I'm not going to have time to talk about loci and mistletoe. Well, let me just say, give you a very brief summary of the story, so I won't read it. This is, go back, Bob, go ahead.
Does the trickster often bring culture? Coco Pally brought music, I think, for instance, with his flute and...
Okay, he doesn't say that. Hyde mentions that Hermes invented the lyre soon after being born, and so he brought music to the Greeks. Yeah, and you're thinking
the Greek guy that bungled everything by stealing Prometheus, I guess. You know, he wasn't really a trickster, but nevertheless, he managed to get the fire from the gods.
Yeah.
And in the process, also brought culture and civilization.
Yeah. Let me just to say a bit more about this theme of fate and contingency. In the Loci story, I was going to read, there's a god named Balder, and some divination indicate that he's doomed to be killed by somebody's weapon. His mother is Frigg and doesn't want that to happen. So she goes throughout the world getting people and things to promise not to use their weapons against her son, Balder. And Loki, the trickster, is sort of offended by this. He wants to do something. And he looks all around and finds that Frigg has failed to get one plant to promise not to harm her son, the mistletoe. So Loki takes a thorn off the mistletoe and gives it to a blind man, who then kills Balder with it. And it's eventually that leads to the twilight of the gods. It's a long story. Everything will be easy. But it plays off contingency and fate. And what religion very often, people don't like contingency. You're like uncertain about something. Something don't change. Some things are definite. And religion very often is like that. So you have the heavens. God is eternal, right? How many times have you heard that? Eternal and unchanging. And here's this trickster, Loki, who capitalizes on fate, on chance. So things could as well be otherwise. All he has to do is find what Frigg overlooks to make things change. In this case, disastrously. We have a few minutes. My next question is, in modern religion, in modern Judeo-Christian Islamic religion, is Satan a trickster? Yeah.
Well, going back to the story about the goddess who ends up leaving the earth because of the dishwater, I was intrigued by the concept that all of the good gets assigned to the god or goddess, and all of the bad gets assigned to the servant. And I like that kind of delegation, you know.
Scapegoat. I think, while I was driving down to California, I think you see on Earth up to date. And so I got to thinking of Carl Jung's brain and memories, dreams, reflections, and some of the other ones he wrote. And I thought to myself, the effect of the psychic energies upon the private itself, you know. And by the result, by that I mean the radios and televisions, you know, like Moses Alexander talks about in his music. Anyway, I went out there, and while I was out there all the way along the way, I would write stories, or write, you know, in the books, you know. And then while I was out there, I bought three blank books, you know. They were just empty pages, and one had a gold cover, one had a green cover, and one had a brown cover. And so I started writing them, you know, and then I set up the stand out there, you know, on Fisherman's Wharf. I don't know if anyone's ever been out there. It's a beautiful place, you know, all the artists go out there and they set up their art stand and crafts and that, you know, and sell there. And I set up a little stand there and I said, help me study the Canadian methods of divination. And I had the tarot cards, the I Ching, and the rose. And I would sit there hours on end, you know, and I would teleport. I sort of, I said, help. I never charged for anything. Sometimes I did it. So I finally left there. I did $3 in their pocket. I hitchhiked all the way back to the city, and I discovered that the San Andreas Fault did not give by the time that
it might eventually.
Well,
they claimed
the scientists at that point in the school said it was a scientific fact that it would give by such and such a date, you know. It did not give. So I think maybe some kind of continuation in that area may be helpful if you conceive that possibly it would give, you know. But of course, I finally came to the conclusion that the soul, or just like the art is greater, is not as great as the artist. The musician is greater than the music. And,
I think that's a point I'll be getting to. Let me just discuss this question about the devil being the trickster. You can make a case for it because the devil is often shown as a trickster in art. So Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust, for example, plays tricks. And I don't know if you remember it. There's a bunch of students drinking in Auerbach's cellar, and Mephistopheles makes fools of them. And Mephistopheles himself is sort of tricked by Faust in scene one. And in the preface, Mephistopheles claims to be on friendly terms with God. But even in Goethe, Mephistopheles doesn't really come off as a trickster. He is rather consistently evil, unlike the trickster. And quoting Goethe, Mephistopheles says, "I am the spirit that always denies, a good thing too, for all that exists deserves to be destroyed. It would be much better if nothing were ever created. So I'm everything that you could call sin and destruction, in short, evil. These are my proper element." But, you know, the trickster is rather often a creative figure. And it's easier to say that the trickster is amoral rather than immoral. And the trickster gets part of our existence where good and evil get all mixed up. Anyway, one of the reasons I got interested in the trickster is several years ago I heard a report at a meeting by some Italian sociologists who wanted to test this out.
So they devised a very ingenious questionnaire, which I don't entirely, I can't really remember, but they to get different kinds of images of Satan that Italians might have, and they administered it to a good sample in Turin, and they found that the Italians thought of Satan as more consistently evil and not as the trickster. Very little evidence that many Italians thought of the trickster as an evil, as a thought of Satan as the trickster. Final question. Yeah, okay, go.
I don't think, though, that we should confuse Satan and the snake in Genesis. That's only doctrinaire Christianity that has made that connection. The snake does bring the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, the snake isn't all evil. The snake simply says, "Don't listen to that guy." He says, "Don't eat that apple." He says, "You eat it, and you got the knowledge of good and evil." I don't see that there's any real moral dilemma there. That serpent is not Satan. It's not Christian Satan.
Good point. Maybe it reflects a more primitive kind of Judaism. Anyway, for people like you and I, or at least some of you and I, is the trickster still around at all, and do we miss the trickster? And part of it, you know, if you and I no longer make the distinction between the sacred and the profane, well, then we no longer need a mediator. Or if the gods are all dead, well, who needs a messenger of the gods anymore? So the question is, do we make distinctions between the sacred and the profane, even the most secular of us? And again, what I do is to refer you to the operational definition of the sacred. If things are sacred, they can be profaned. And it happens all the time for even the most secular of us. For really important things, where sacred ideals of human dignity are profaned. You can probably come up with examples, John.
Hell with Jesus.
What?
Velvet paint with Jesus.
Oh.
Jesus painted on velvet.
Yeah.
Right.
The cheapening. This is the cheapening of the religion, the velvet paintings of Jesus.
Years and years ago, the cover of there were some back there in the benighted eras of the 1950s or 1960s when Southern blacks were really repressed. The Ku Klux Klan dressed up in their finery, showed up at the house of some poor blacks and gave them a chicken for Christmas or something like that. And you know, it's sort of the mixture of symbols that sort of profanes things.
What about the continuing concern that one person's sacred is another's neutral or profane? I heard rumors when someone mentioned the velvet pane. For some people, that might be infinitely sacred. And you know, that's it. I hate to say everything's relative. It's all things say, except that it is true. You indicated in your stories how much cultural perspective had to do with anything, and how some of the tales said, "You do it your way, but don't try to do it my way, and I'll do it my way. My way belongs to me." So, you know, it's certainly not pushing for ecumenism, but it does seem like the myths are saying there are different ways that you mean different things to different people, and let's keep it that way.
Tell me when I have to quit.
No.
let me just say. Then I'll claim the last 2 minutes. Actually, in everyday life, there's sort of a distinction between sacred and profane. We have
ideals of sacred individuality, and we have little rituals in everyday life that protect these. And one of the characteristics of people who get defined as insane is that they very often violate the little rituals by not protecting your personal space. Well, you know, they might come right up to your nose, or they might ask questions that are defined in public that are defined as too personal, or things like that. Or they might not respect their own sacred individuality by drooling at the dinner table, or farting while we're in, things like that. And you can see these little rituals. There are these distinctions between the sacred and the profane, and so it's still meaningful for us. And in that case, we might still find a use for the trickster. Lewis Hyde argues that in the modern world, the mediators are quite likely to be artists. Artists really often do work on the boundaries of the sacred and the profane, and in ways that really bother people. I don't think you are really seriously bothered by pictures of Jesus on black velvet, will you?
No.
But Richard Serrano, a few years ago, almost brought down the National Endowment for the Arts by his picture of a crucifix encased with his own urine. And I can, Senator Helms got onto that. More recently, there's the London artist of African origins who created a furor with the Virgin and the elephant dung. Artists often work on these margins. Tricksters upset things, like Richard Serrano and this London artist. Picasso was a very good example. But then in other art forms, you find characters like Woody Allen. Woody Allen still very often involve very profound sacred issues, but they're always sort of on the margin, And, and other, you can probably think of it. Okay.
Okay, thank you,
Warren.
Any guests or visitors who'd like to introduce themselves to be introduced?
My stepchildren are visiting from St. Louis, and my step-grandchildren. This is Alex and Zach, and the other two are downstairs, and then Dean and Rick.
I walked into Prairie this morning, and in the front hall as I was entering,
Marilyn
with this huge smile on,
because
people had just come in the door right in front of me. Yes.
Hi, I'm Charlene Sexton, and I've been a tender at a Friends Quaker meeting for about 4 or 5 years. I've got a very, very dear friend of mine, Mary Ong, who's very active in the UU in Asheville, North Carolina, and she would want me for sure to greet you. I'm very pleased to be here. I came in part because of today's program, but I'm just wanting to visit other places.
Good to have you with us this morning. Other guests or visitors? That pregnant pause. It's not a requirement, but you can introduce yourselves after the service also, and we'll have a coffee and conversation. Whatever your pleasure. Prayer announcements. Rick.
It's the prairie fire deadline, and the green folder is in the office there. So you give your notices there or email them to me. I promise to read the email this week before I do the prayer. I found this set of keys in the back door. In the door on the outside.
Out back there.
Is there a building key on it?
Rick, they're proud of mine, but I did it this morning. So.
Oh, okay. The big load of keys here.
Good catch.
Good catch.
Other prayer announcements. Orange.
Since I brought up this idea, it's falling back in my lap, which is only appropriate.
Yeah.
I'm going to be arranging for new bindings on the songbooks because some of them have got kind of ratty looking. A few of them have lost their covers. However, gives us an opportunity if there's something you desperately want to change in the song that we're not going to. Someone said, well, the words are too small. I'm not taking good covers. But if there is something that you would love to have added in the songbook or something that you would find morally offensive, strongly enough, you want to work on it, see me. Rosemary Lester is also, I believe, the collecting thing, but she's not here today. And we'll do this over the next few weeks.
Would the Shalom song be fixed by someone musical who can fix it?
I will do that. See someone musical, and then they can see me. I'm not fixing music either.
Did you do that, Delita? Do you know what's wrong with it?
You can
talk about it.
Nikki.
A couple of announcements from the program committee. One, we desperately need some more program committee members. We've lost a couple. So please rush to me to tell me you want to be on the program committee. And the second thing is that we need a person who would like to coordinate the Easter intergenerational service. After the grape one, which sort of got snowed out, those of us who were here for the Valentine one, which is really fun, I'm sure there are people out there who do a really cool Easter one, so do rush to me and tell me that you want to coordinate the Easter intergenerational service.
Or at least progress at a steady rate towards in a timely fashion. Rachel?
Well, a number of you have received from the Central Midwest District a challenge to send $10 to the Chalice Lighters, which is a program run by the Central Midwest District to help out societies who have special needs. And I'll put something in the Prairie Fire about that. So I'll be sitting out there at the table. If you'd like to join 20 of us who are signed up, we'd love to have you.
Hillary is considering writing a Child Players grant probably for the August deadline. I would do with our EN. You get a better chance of getting a grant if you have Child Players in your congregation. Karen?
Regarding the conferences on the planning for conflict in Unitarian churches, and to go to this conference, you have to be able to send at least 3 people, but up to 6 people can go. And 2 of us are definitely interested. I'm going, and Marilyn Reckon is going, and we need a third person who might be interested in going, and there has been, I understand, some funding put aside for hardship. If you need help. And so please talk to me. I have the registration forms. They want us to register. I have 3 registration forms. If there's more than 3, that would be great. But so please rush to me after excited about preparing for conflict and
registration.
And you know, I think it really would be exciting to send a team of people to go.
Yeah. This is the idea of this conflict resolution training. The president of Central Midwest District is one of the co-leaders of this workshop, and they really want teams to come. And I think we have a third, we might have a fourth, but anyone who's interested, please ask. Delita.
Next Sunday service is going to be titled Between Nicey Nice and Spilling Blood. Now, I think most of you know what that means. There's been an expression of a little need for it. We all need it. And you're looking at someone who could use it. It's not going to be a prairie fix-all service. It's going to be an informative service with techniques for interaction. And I propose that those of you who come with a kind of opportunity to learn for yourself and let the other guy take care of himself. Thank you. And maybe understand why it is you haven't told the other guy that the other guy ought to be there.
But gym clothes are not required.
Gym clothes.
Gym clothes are back. Gymnasium clothes are back. Ken.
As Mayor Carl Prairie adopted a mission statement at our last parish meeting in November, and those of you who are interested are welcome to meet with us after the program today to review the mission statement, see if you want to make any adjustments in the statement.
Thank you, Ken. Other announcements?
I just want to, this is an announcement.
announcement about a non-event, primarily directed towards board members, because we had discussed the fact that as of the 19th of March, there will be the service auction, which has a potluck associated with it. The prior week is Secret Friends potluck. We figured then that three potlucks in a row is not good, so March 5th will not be a potluck with a dessert given by committee members. I'm going to be putting in an announcement from Prairie Fire, which sort of says, if you're interested in being a member, please call a member of the Committee on Committees, and we will dispense with it, because otherwise we might be potlucked too many in a row. So the 12th, yes, for Secret Friends. The 19th, yes, for the service auction, but not the 5th.
The Committee on Committees has, from what I hear from KK, been doing a good job contacting people, not only people to serve on our board, but also people to serve on committees. So if any of you have been neglected, I'm sure that KK or other members on the Committee on Committee would be glad if you rushed to them. Other announcements? Okay, I've got two. This afternoon at 4 o'clock, with the reception at 4:30, Joan H. Armstrong is going to be installed as a parish minister at First Society. She's the RE person there. So if anyone wants to reach out to other IU people, go and see some UUs in another church and their RE director. The other thing is, there is a art exhibit which Fran Zell wrote the commentary for. It's called The Whole...
It's wonderful.
M-I-S-H-P-O-C-H-E-N, a celebration of life. Mixed
really nice.
Really? Oh, well, good for you. I don't have a clue. But it's mixed media drawings and serigraphs. And there is the same postcard on the board. It goes through February 28th.
Where is it?
It's at the Madison Public Library. Central Library. Any other announcements? Yes.
I could use someone to help me with dishes today. I see
yes.
on the sign up that I'm the only one there.
Yes.
Is there somebody who can help?
Yes, Robin.
Yeah, I'll help.
Oh, okay. See, good turns come back too, for all the bad turns. Okay. Our last hymn is hymn number 7.
I think number 5.
Oh, okay, it's not my reading glasses. Good.
Thank you.
through the trickster and Satan and ended up with unrest. So I wish you all a little bit of unrest on the way to the Stay safe for coffee and conversation. Thank you.
I didn't see how that I'm going to go to the next one.